Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the Republican juggernaut rolls full steam ahead, GOP strategist and power broker Grover Norquist is cranking away in the engine room. If it matters in Washington, chances are he's working on it. Tonight on Point, Grover Norquist and the Republican vision of 21st century America. We begin in Washington with a look at Grover Norquist's role in the GOP power elite. Nicholas Confessore is an editor at the Washington Monthly magazine. He has a piece in the July-August issue entitled Welcome to the Machine, How the GOP Disciplined K Street and Made Bush Supreme. I asked him to describe the Republican movement that Mr. Norquist is spearheading.
He is part of a wave of conservatives who came of age in the Reagan Revolution, and over the last 15 or 20 years have really taken over their party and turned it from one that had a kind of pragmatic establishment wing and a social conservative grassroots wing into one which is much more unified ideologically across the board, both in terms of the relationships different players in the GOP coalition have with each other and in the way it functions from day to day.
We're going to hear from Grover Norquist himself in a moment, but how would you, sitting outside as a third party watching on, how would you describe the focus of this GOP movement now?
Well, you know, Grover's main job, he runs something called the Wednesday Group meetings, which are his invention. And the origins of those meetings were people who got together to defeat Bill Clinton's health care plan back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And Grover's, I think, his basic model is not to figure out what everybody is going to do together necessarily, but about things they don't want. He calls it the Leave Us Alone Coalition.
Things that who doesn't want?
Things that different conservatives don't want.
I see.
He creates ways and ideas that they can all get around together, often in opposition to begin with. And now, as it's matured, he finds ways of getting, say, a business lobbyist to support something that Phil Schlafly, a social conservative, might want. So, for instance, once he told me in an interview, if he wanted to build support or opposition to a gas tax, mm-hmm. he would explain to Phil Schlafly that a gas tax is a kind of population control, because if gas is more expensive, it's hard to own a big car. And if you don't have a big car, you can't have a big family.
Okay.
And that's how he'd get a social conservative group behind something that the business community doesn't want or doesn't want.
So right? He'll place himself kind of at the nexus and then pull groups together within the Republican Party.
Yeah, his is basically an anti-government kind of persona ideology. He's very anti-taxes, and of course, opposition to taxes is the glue of today's GOP, which is why President Bush wants to pass a tax cut every year while he's in office. And it's really important to have someone like Grover. These people meet every single week in a conference room in Washington. There are over 100 of them every week. It includes political operatives and lobbyists and consultants and conservative journalists, people from the White House, people from Congress, from Tom DeLay's office. And it's where they get out, you know, get together to hash out a message for one thing. And there is really no equivalent of this on the left whatsoever. There have been attempts to start it. The closest thing I know of, something called the Tuesday group on the mm-hmm. left, but it's much more focused on liberals, whereas I think that Grover, in spite of the fact that Grover hates moderates, he wants the widest possible coalition on anything, whereas liberals and centrists in the Democratic Party are still fighting for control of the party.
So there's a message component, the message of the week. There's nitty-gritty operations about how to accomplish things, and all this under a kind of ideological banner of less government or minimal government.
The way he would put it is homeschoolers want the government out of our school, and businesses want the government, you know, they want less taxes, they want the government off their backs. Landowners want the EPA off their backs. So it's the Leave Us Alone Coalition.
One of the levers that gets pulled here is what's called the K Street Project. Can you describe that for us?
The K Street Project has been around in one form or another since the late 1990s. The actual K Street Project, as Grover runs it, the offices of his organization, Americans for Tax Reform, is an attempt to track the partisan affiliation and giving patterns of every lobbyist in Washington. Now, so far, it hasn't been run that well because they haven't put enough resources behind it. This is public, by the way. You can see the document on their website.
And this is not just to track, but to influence. In other words, to try and get, ultimately, I guess, all lobbyist dollars into GOP pockets, not into Democrat pockets. Is that right?
I think, actually, that Grover has a much broader application in mind, although that's certainly part of it. He wants you to be able to look in his book and see how loyal somebody is.
How loyal an industry or a lobbying
group is. Or a lobbyist is. And so if there's some quizzling Republican lobbyist who has given a couple of bucks to a Democrat to stay on their good side, he can put them to the back of a line behind somebody who has given no money to Democrats, who's never worked for or with a Democrat.
And the interest here is to line up dollars and industry support for Republican initiatives, but also to cement the Republican Party in power. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think in the short term, you want to put pressure on the lobbyists to give you more of their money. In the long term, it's a way to figure out who are the good guys from your perspective so that you can reward them. And one of the big ways of rewarding them is with the best lobbying jobs. So somebody who has proven themselves to be reliable for the party, not necessarily for the industry they're representing, but for the party, will be rewarded over the long term with one of the top lobbying jobs. There are about a few hundred of them in Washington. And therefore, once you do that, the lobbyists at this big trade association owe something to you.
Their jobs, their
exactly.
careers.
Their jobs and their careers. And so in a sense, you begin to have a party takeover of K Street. The sort of conventional view is that lobbyists influence politicians and corrupt politicians. But in reality, it's much more the fact that politicians put the touch on lobbyists.
In this case, that K Street, of course, being the kind of the heart of lobbyist land in Washington, D.C., that the Republicans would have maximum sway over that stretch of property there and the people who work in it. Grover Norquist told David Broder recently, he said, we are going to dig out, speaking of the Democratic Party and its initiatives over the last decades, we are going to dig out their whole structure of programs and power. I guess this gets to the minimalist government ideology you described. How would you describe the success of Norquist and the GOP group around him on that project? Have they made a good start, sort of laying the foundation for taking federal government down to bare bones?
Well, on the K Street side, on the lobbyist side, they've certainly made a good start. And they're at a point now where they can really dictate the hiring at the top places. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
On the broader project, you know, you have to say it's all in progress. The two pillars of Democratic governance are Medicare and Social Security. And despite all their efforts, they really have not been able to crack that. I think Medicare is moving a little more rapidly down the road towards voucherization or some form of privatization. But Social Security privatization was a bust in 2000. And they put a lot of effort into that, the Cato Institute and Grover. You know, for instance, Grover Norquist is another example of his role. It's fascinating. He hired a guy who wrote one of the first books on private Social Security back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he got this guy to be commissioned by all the big trade associations, by about seven of them, to put together a privatization proposal for each group that would dovetail and lock together. And as Grover put it to me, the important thing was to make sure that everybody had the same 10 or 15 steps in mind. Now, maybe some places wanted to pursue it more aggressively or more quickly than other places. The important thing is that we all agreed on the 10 things that had to be done in Social Security.
So this is the power broker. This is where it all comes together and, as you say, gets dovetailed.
Yes.
And that's Grover Norquist. Nicholas Confessori, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Confessori is an editor for the Washington Monthly magazine. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. No less than Newt Gingrich has called him the most innovative, creative, courageous, and entrepreneurial leader of the anti-tax efforts and of conservative grassroots activism in America. Grover Norquist says Gingrich has truly changed American history, from shrinking the federal government to tightening Republican control of the lobbyists that feed political coffers. Grover Norquist has his hands deep in the key initiatives that party elites hope will mean GOP governing control for a long, long time. But of a very different kind of government. Norquist once said, my goal is to cut government in half in 25 years to get it down to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub. These days, it can seem that Norquist's GOP is on its way to succeeding. It's a bold, maybe radical vision, and so far, step by step, with 3 years of tax cuts in a row now, it's happening. Tonight, we'll hear the world according to GOP ideological warrior Grover Norquist. What's the real vision here, the new GOP ideal? And are you on board? Is Grover Norquist's America the country you want your children to live in? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Grover Norquist. He is president of Americans for Tax Reform and sits on the board of directors of the National Rifle Association and the American Conservative Union. Slate magazine calls him the Rasputin of the right. A new generation of Republicans call him a genius and a prophet. Good evening and welcome, Grover Norquist.
Glad to be with you.
Good to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Grover Norquist, take us in here. Paint the picture for us. You have the attribute of speaking pretty plainly, and we'd like you to paint the picture of the United States in the year, you name it, 2020, 2030, 2050. If it all comes to pass just the way you hope, what will this country look like compared to today?
Well, what's happened and what Nick Confessori was talking about is a change in the center-right coalition throughout the Reagan years. I mean, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, the Republican Party was a regional party. It was the party of the North. If you were born north of the Mason-Dixon line, you were Republican. If you were born south of the Mason-Dixon line, you were Democrat. And it didn't have anything to do with your view of the role of government or individual liberty. It was regional. There were religious differences. Catholic immigrants tended to be Democrats, Protestant Republicans, which is not a very rational way to organize a political party. In the 70s, in the 80s, with President Reagan's initiatives, the Republican Party became the party of all of those individuals who, on the issue that brings them to politics, what they want from the government is to be left alone. Again, gun owners want to be left alone, want their guns left alone. Taxpayers leave their income alone. Homeschoolers want to be left alone to raise their own children. All communities of faith, whether it's Orthodox Jews or evangelical Christians or conservative Catholics, Mormons, Muslims, want to be left alone to raise their own children as they see fit and pass on their own values and not have the government throwing prophylactics at their kids.
We've got that at the ideological level, but I wish you'd paint a more kind of visceral picture. I mean, once you've got government down and you drown it in the bathtub, sure, and everyone's left alone, what does this country, what does this society look like? How does it work compared to now?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, the goal is to drop the size and cost of government in half over 25 years. On the question of, say, something like Social Security, President Bush has talked about in 2000 giving everyone the option of going to taking your FICA taxes and put some, and I hope eventually all, if you'd like, into a 401k or an individual retirement account so that people could save for their future rather than have the government run their pension plan for them. If you were able to take your FICA taxes and put them in a 401k, you would retire with a great deal more wealth and more income than under the present plan, which is going to go bankrupt if we continue along the route we're on. But were to give everyone that option, and if everyone took it, the federal government would shrink by about 20 to 25% over the next 20, 30 years. So that's a big step right there.
There's just one step. And Grover Norquist, we want to hear more of the detail that you have in mind there, because, of course, it's more than just a lot of 401ks. It's really a different America than what we knew from much of the 20th century. We're going to come back and have you fill in the rest of that mural. I want to bring Jack Beatty in for just a moment here. Jack, you've got the sense of this project and where Grover would have us go. And right now we seem to be headed there.
Yeah, well, you know, along with Frank Luntz, I think it was Grover who performed a kind of lexical surgery on the inheritance tax, and they called it a death tax, and succeeded in making people say, by God, you can't tax death, and we're not going to do it anymore. And that was quite a triumph. I want to do a similar bit of lexical prestidigitation on tax cuts. I want to call them service cuts hereafter. And I think our listeners should think, when he says tax cuts, they mean service cuts. And in Grover's world, you know, we inspect our own meat, our drugs, our products. We build our own highways. We clean our own air. We buy our own national parks. We work till we drop because Social Security has gone bust in another stock market dip. We homeschool our own kids. We do our own cancer research. We want to be let alone, and by God, we're going to be let alone.
We'll come back and see if that is what Grover Norquist means. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the GOP's number one ideological warrior? Is Grover Norquist's America the country you want your children to live in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with GOP, political mover and shaker, activist, and make-it-happen guy in Washington, Grover Norquist, about the new GOP vision for America and how it's being made reality. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the GOP's number one ideological warrior? Grover Norquist wants to drown federal government in the bathtub. Are you on board? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Grover Norquist, Jack Beatty was just laying out a picture there where we inspect our own meat and build our own roads and we all homeschool our kids. Is that what you mean when you envision the future?
No, that's silly. What we're talking about doing is taking programs that the government runs and replacing them with voluntary efforts that are they're more successful and that we know from history and from looking at what goes on in the world can be done better.
But be specific, meat inspection or road voluntary road building, is that what you mean or not?
No, I mean, let's take a look at the big items. I mean, I'm not talking about abolishing the government. We're talking about dropping it in half in terms of its costs over the next 25 years.
Well, what does the drown in the bathtub part mean?
No. You got to catch the whole quotation there. It is it comes from, I don't want to abolish the government. I want to reduce it into the size to the size where you could take it into the bathroom and drown it in the tub. You want it small enough. It's not a question of drowning it. It's an expression. It's hyperbole.
So you're not saying you would
poetry.
Drown it. It's poetry.
Correct.
Pure
poetry.
Be
small enough.
Small enough
small
that you could
enough.
If you felt like it.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay. I got it.
Were you to go and allow people voucherize education, to say to somebody, the federal government, state government, local governments in D.C. spend $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 per child in D.C. and said, tell you what, we'll give you $3,000 if you would like to send your child to a private school or to homeschool. You wouldn't, in D.C., drop the cost of education by about a third. People would have a chance to go to better alternative schools if they wish. We're talking about doing this voluntarily. If you think that the D.C. schools are competent and do a good job and keep your kids drug-free and educate them and provide quality education, then you're perfectly able to stay in the government-run schools. The teachers' unions, however, know perfectly well that given half a chance that the young children of D.C. and their parents would like to move them into competent private schools.
But given half the budget, there'd really be no way to make the public schools effective. I mean, I guess what I want to get at...
Only a few years ago, we were paying half for public schools, and they were better, not worse schools. You think spending another $1,000 in D.C. will improve public education in D.C.?
I'm going to stay absolutely out of it. What I'm trying to get is the picture of the America that you imagine functioning in this way. Does everyone become kind of frontiers people again, self-reliant, building their own neighborhood schools? Is there a change in fundamental attitude towards society, government interaction with community that you would like this to engender, to bring about?
Absolutely. We want everyone to have the opportunity to be have more self-control of their own lives, of their families, more independence. People who own 401ks and IRAs, and 70% of Americans today, 70% of voters, about 65-65% of all American adults, own shares of stock. As more and more Americans have IRAs and 401ks, they're able to have control of their own retirement.
Well, until the stock market bottoms out.
Well, if the stock market collapsed, then Social Security would collapse too, because the economy had collapsed. In point of fact, people in the market today are better off than they were if they went in. You know, over time, we have about a 7% historic rate of return over 100 years. And again, you don't have to be in the stock market. You could put your money in a bank account and get a fixed rate or a bond with a fixed rate. You can decide what level of risk and return you would want to handle on that.
Right, got that. But I don't want to get lost in the labyrinth of 401ks. It's really the fundamental character of the society you'd like to see pull out here that I want to get at.
But the investor class changes the country, because when people have control over their own resources and their own retirement savings, it changes the nature of who they are. They're not scared by the politicians anymore who say, do what we want or we'll take away your Social Security.
And this country then is made up of every family sitting on its own bottom, fending for itself, and in that way, in your view, better.
Well, you give people control over their own lives, their own resources, their own ability to make their own decisions. Yeah, significantly better than a government that comes in and pushes you around and tells you what to do and makes you significantly poorer. Social Security makes people poorer than they would be if they could save and invest their own money. And that is true for every single American in the country has been made poorer. Because if they had saved and invested their own money that was otherwise taken in Social Security taxes, they would have more money and more income today. And that's more true for younger Americans who will never see any meaningful Social Security.
Mm. Jack Beatty, every tub on its own bottom in the world that Grover Norquist anticipates with a couple more decades of GOP dominance in Washington, is that the world you want to live in?
Well, let's sort of give a day in my life, all right? And I'll just and we'll point out how this federal government is on my back really from the beginning. The alarm clock goes on, and wouldn't you know, it's NPR. Gets public subsidy right there on the alarm clock. I go down to get breakfast, the milk, the meat, the butter. Federal inspections, by God, it's just bogging the economy down. I have to take some medicine. The FDA is just getting in the way of the revolutionary medicine that I need. I need get this bureaucracy off my back. I go to my desk. There's a picture of my dad there. He couldn't have retired without Social Security, and he certainly couldn't have retired without Medicare. It made it possible for my mother and my father to live in dignity in their last years. Worth a lot to me. I turn on my computer. Hey, wait a minute. Government research started the computer industry. I click on the Internet. The Internet, DARPA, a defense program, was the entrepreneur of the Internet. Well, I come down, I get out of the house, and if I could climb the big tree in my backyard, I could see Mount Washington in the distance. And now National Park. God, get that off my back. I get onto my bus to take me to Boston. And by gosh, I'm going down the interstate highway. The taxes for these highways, I want that stopped. And meanwhile, the bus is safe because, of course, it's had this ICC regulations. By God, I want leaky exhaust. I don't want this taxes holding me down. And the speed limit. And by the way, the city of Boston now is cleaner than it was two decades ago. Why is that? Well, the EPA regulations, which are slowing down the economy. All right, on the way down, I'm reading a book. What am I reading about government in the economy in the 19th century? Basically, you know, you get the Erie Canal. It cuts the price of potatoes in New York City by two-thirds. Railroads, land grants, 100 million acres of government land given to the railroads made your state possible, Tom. No Illinois without the Illinois Central, and no Illinois Central without the land grant. I get to Boston, and what have I got? I've got the South Station, a whole you know, panoply of commuter rail and so on going. I've got the subway. I walk by the old State House. National Park preserves that. Taxes are just holding me down. I go by a sign for the University of Massachusetts. I got an education there. Land Grant College. Get this off my back. I mean, and to cut to the chase, I wasn't mugged. I didn't need the fire department. And yes, I spent the day in the USA, not in Germany, Japan, or the USSR, all because of this darn government.
Jack, you break me up. Grover Norquist, there's Jack Beatty's view of a day, and I guess he's joking with government on his back. He wants it right there, and he paints a whole picture of things he wants to stick with. How many of those would be gone in the government cut in half that you imagine?
Well, let's go through it. He starts the day. He drinks his milk, which costs several times what it would normally cost if the government didn't have milk support programs to steal money from poor children and families and give it to milk producers.
So you take away the milk support but leave the inspector? Or are we going to drink unpasteurized, or how does that work in this future?
Well, two things. First of all, there's no reason to not have safety inspections. If you want to have the government run them, if that makes you feel more comfortable, that's not one of the significant costs of government. You could also have competing, if you want to have competing groups that would do safety, you could look at that. But for right now, look at the government doing the safety questions, but when the government gets into the milk industry, it doesn't spend its time making it safe. It spends its time making it more expensive. Oh, by the way, the same thing for your butter. The question that we got into on Social Security, every person would be better off if they could have invested their money in the stock market, even in rather than paying into Social Security, even if they'd gotten at the height of the market and gotten out at the end of a 50-year period. The idea
roads, that, police, fire, education, university.
Okay, well, I think we're talking in Boston here with the Boston here with the big dig, roads that cost a third more than they would because of the Davis-Bacon regulations put in specifically to keep black Americans out of unionized government jobs passed in the 20s and the 30s. So all government roads that are paid for with government money cost somewhere about 30% more than they would because of government regulations specifically designed to keep African Americans out of unionized jobs. We also have ICC regulations on the buses we talked about, which increase the cost of buses in this country when the ICC was setting prices for buses and rail and trucks by about 90 on trucking, $90 billion a year cost, deadweight cost to the economy because of the regulations of the trucking industry.
So
buses
is the fundamental,
cost 20% more.
Is the fundamental notion here then in your mind, Grover, that when citizens get together to accomplish goals through government, that it is just inevitably inefficient, and therefore they shouldn't get together to do things via government?
Well, no, there's some things that the government can and should do competently. We have national security, we have courts, we can have safety regulations, but when the government gets into subsidies and price fixing and sets up ICC regulations, it's not only that it costs more. When we deregulated trucking in the 70s and the 80s, buses, trucks, and rail, we tripled the number of African Americans who owned bus companies and the number of women who owned bus companies. These are people who are kept out of those industries because of barriers to entry created by government regulations.
Jack Beattie, there's a paradise here in Grover Norquist's view that you're just missing.
I am missing it. Maybe because I grew up in the 20th century, and Grover is telling me that, man, I had it rough. Things could have been so much better if we didn't have the Fair Deal and the New Deal, if we didn't have Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and FDR, if we didn't have Dwight Eisenhower and the interstate commerce, and the interstate highway, if we didn't have Richard Nixon and the EPA, what a paradise we'd be living in.
What a paradise we'd live in. We have a lot of callers who want to talk with Grover Norquist. We're going to invite them in. Kathy is calling from Danvers, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My phone is echoing, so I'm going to try to... I have to tell you that I'm listening to Mr. Norquist talk, and I am terrified by the picture that I see America will become.
Why? What? Why?
Because I think that there are, first of all, some things should never be done for profit and never will make a profit, taking care of in mostly human services. And
that's a pretty broad area. That's housing, that's daycare, that's Head Start, that's a lot of things, right?
That's a lot of things, yes. But I'm speaking specifically of people who can't take care of themselves, who need people to take care of them. Will you privatize that? And I think that we'll be in big trouble, more trouble than we are in with tax cuts.
But what about unlocking all the efficiencies that Grover is describing here? You know, let you handle these things the way you want to, get government out of it, and maybe you can get twice as much service for the same money.
I think that's a lot of BS. I think that he doesn't realize how complicated and how difficult it is, and also that you need people who are objective, overseeing the things that are being done, because especially in human services, you know, you don't know what's happening unless someone comes in and inspects it. And you need that.
Grover, what do you say to Kathy?
I don't work for the state. I work for a private company and have worked for quite a few over the years. and have seen things happen, that if you couldn't call the state and have the state come in, that it would be a very bad situation.
We've got it. Grover Norquist.
Again, I mean, this is sort of silly. I mean, the idea, we're not talking about having no government. We're talking about reducing the cost of government and taking a look at those things that government does that are absolutely destructive of human happiness. I'm sorry, but a government program which makes the cost of sugar three times the world price because we're subsidizing a handful of rich sugar magnates because they have political power is a bad and evil thing. It is the government hurting people every day that it does this. It does this.
Human services is Kathy's particular interest, I guess.
Okay, but what does she mean if by human services you mean something like pension plans for people's future? And this is why it is hugely important that people have the opportunity to have IRAs and 401ks so that they can control their own future, medical savings accounts so people can save and have control, not have some HMO or some government bureaucrat tell you with government rationing as they have in Canada. You want the government to run health care? Then they ration. They tell you you're too old, you don't get the transplant, kid, you're gonna die. That's government rationing. And that's what we need to avoid by giving people the opportunity to save and invest and take care of themselves and their own health and not have the government come in and say, as they do in Europe, as they do in Canada, hey, we've got one size fits all and you don't make the cut, so you don't get the organ, you don't get the operation, or you get to wait 6 months, 8 months. And if you're alive in Canada, then you can have the operation.
Kathy, thanks for your call. Les is calling from Milford, Massachusetts. Hi, Les.
Hi there.
Good evening.
Good evening. My comment is to point out that I think you two guys, Tom and Jack, are taking the comments of your guest, Mr. Norquist, a little bit too far. And I'd like to express a little more support for what he's trying to say than you guys seem
go,
to.
Go for it. Go for it.
You know, I don't hear him saying that he wants to stop the inspection of meat
thank you.
Dairy and so on. What I do hear him saying is that he thinks there are many areas where we can privatize our government actions and give power more to the individuals and to the people. Particularly, I've heard him say that about Social Security, and that's an area in which I concur. It seems to me that that's reasonable. The comment that Jack Beatty made about driving down from, New Hampshire into Boston was cute and interesting, but frankly, I think it was a little disingenuous because it was pushing the envelope of what your guest was really trying to say. And I think you need to give him a little more credit.
We're looking to give credit here tonight, but Les, what's your just gut feeling here? Grover's talking about cutting federal government in half. Does that seem about the right diminution of federal government to your mind? Would that leave us the country with the services that you would see as fundamentally important?
Personally, I think that's stretching it too far. But I've also found that if you don't set a lofty goal, you frequently don't end up achieving anything. So I don't know. I don't think a half, 50% reduction in the federal government size is really a reasonable target. But maybe a third reduction is.
But you're ready to.
Why not let him take a crack at a third at 50%? Maybe we'll end up with 25% by the time the politicians are all done arguing about it.
Okay, Les, we've got it. Thanks for your call. We're talking tonight with Grover Norquist about the new GOP vision for America. And now it's being made reality. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the GOP's number one ideological warrior? Is Grover Norquist's America the country you want your children to live in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Grover Norquist about the new GOP vision for America and how it's being made a reality. You can join the conversation. Does the GOP have a good shot now at one-party rule for a long, long time? When you hear the dream of a tax cut every year, do you say bring them on or slow them down? Is this America's future? And is Grover Norquist the voice of 21st century Washington, 21st century America? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Sam's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, when I hear these types of conversations, I was listening for a while, so I had a little time to refine my question, I guess, is that Your guest seems to come from the point of view that he mistrusts government. And I think I come from the point of view that I mistrust corporate business. And I'm just, I always thought of government as one of the many things it does is it protects the interests of the Commonwealth against the interests of business. And let me just state my assumptions out front.
Okay.
My assumption is the interest of business is purely to make a profit at any cost. And to the degree that a business is efficient, it's only efficient at one thing, and that's maximizing profit. I think when we saw the banking scandals a couple of years back and the scandal now with Enron and all that other stuff, it was they were efficient to one end, and that was to make a profit. And they'll do that at any cost. So I'm just wondering if Grover would agree with me to some degree that business is not to be trusted either, and one of the primary goals of government is to protect the Commonwealth against the single tunnel vision interest of business, which is just to make a profit.
We've got it, Sam. Thanks for your call. Grover Norquist.
He raises two good points. You had the savings and loan scandal where a lot of people stole an awful lot of money because the federal government guaranteed the insurance, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The federal government was supposed to make sure that none of that happened. In point of fact, because there was a guarantee behind it, these people were able to gamble with your and my taxpayer money. There was no private sector insurance to require banks to be careful. So that is a perfect example of where the government cost all of us hundreds of billions of dollars because they got involved in quote-unquote insuring banks rather than allowing the private sector to do so. And then when people started making goofy decisions, they would have said, you can't do that. We're not insuring you if you're going to be taking risks.
To Sam's point, then, do you think that the government does not have a role in moderating private corporate behavior?
Well, the point was that you have that what moderates private behavior in the marketplace are competitors, and competitors who say, don't go into that bank, it's not safe. When the government comes in and says, we have nationalized the idea of insuring these banks, we will do it, we will make the one-size-fits-all monopoly rules. All government are monopolies. And
but didn't the 90s disprove that this idea that competition would fix everything? I mean, Enron... Well, you know the Enron story, and there's a bunch of others out there. There was competition, but there wasn't exactly oversight that kept us out of trouble.
Let's see. Enron was caught, what, by the SEC, by some government bureaucrat? No. The Enron, the fact that somebody at Enron was cheating and was borrowing money that they weren't putting on the books, mm-hmm. was caught by a private sector investment operation which said, we look at this and we say that it's not doing the right thing. Look, people can cheat and try and rob banks and so on and do bad things. The question is, how quickly can you catch them? The market catches bad behavior. Competitors catch bad behavior faster than monopoly government does. The government didn't fix Enron. The private sector caught Enron. And how did the private sector punish Enron? It bankrupted it, and it drove it into the ground. The government, there's no government bureaucrat that caught Enron. And the banking scandal he mentioned, the banking FDIC challenges, was a government-created scandal. So he makes two very good points, both of which make my case that monopolies do a very bad job of whatever they're supposed to be doing, and governments, by definition, are monopolies. There's
Grover,
only one of them.
Grover, how do you think this is catching on? What's your sense of the GOP's prospects right now in Congress and the White House for a real good long run at government control or control of the federal government in the United States?
Well, there are a couple of things. There's one, there's just the mechanics of it. Every 10 years, the House of Representatives is redistricted. And because you can look at all the new districts that were designed in 2002, you can tell whether Republicans or Democrats are likely to carry them because they kind of gerrymander them for one party or the other. And the Republican Party will control the House of Representatives for the next 10 years. In 2012, there'll be another redistricting, and it's possible that it could become more or less Republican at that point. But for the next 10 years, the U.S. House of Representatives will be under Republican control, just as for 40 years it was under Democratic control, largely for the last two decades of that because of gerrymandered districts. Then when you look at the Senate, there are 30 states that Bush carried in 2000, 20 states that Gore carried in 2000, and that was a fairly evenly balanced election there. There should be, over the next 4 and 6 years, about 60 Republicans in the Senate and 40 Democrats as the red states elect Republican senators to go along with their Bush votes. So we are looking at about 10 years. And of course, the presidency is always dicier, but I tend to think Bush is likely to get reelected. We're looking at over the next 10 years, Congress controlled by the Republicans, probably a Republican president, and therefore steps that we're taking, not radical big changes or whatever, but small steps. Every year there's been a small tax cut.
Small tax cut.
Yeah, well, small compared to the size of the economy and compared to the size of the government. We're looking at abolishing the death tax, which 70%+ of the American people want to do. We're looking at expanding IRAs and 401ks so every American can participate in them. So these sorts of reforms, giving people the option of controlling their own retirement. If you like the present system, you can stay in it. If you'd prefer to run your own IRA and 401k personal savings account, you should be able to do that as well. So there are a number of modest steps in the right direction. The president's talking about allowing the outsourcing of about half of federal employment. Mm. Half of the federal jobs that are done right now by government workers have been ruled not inherently governmental.
David Broder in the Washington Post quotes you as saying, I think the smart guys on the left have known for a long time they are in trouble and that we're going to dig out their whole structure of programs and power. In Broder's description, he says what you're talking about is wiping clean a century's accumulation of social programs designed to provide a safety net beneath the private economy. Would you describe the goal the same way?
No. What Broder was asking was, in my writing a piece for the Washington Post and explaining that there was a tax cut each year and that this was going to be continuing over the next 10 years because of Republican control of Washington, he said, don't you think you're tipping your hand to the Democrats? And my observation was, no, I think that the smart Democrats have seen this coming. Not that they can do anything about it, but they see it coming. It's not a surprise to them that we're going to be reducing the size and scope and cost of government. There are a number of things that we're talking about doing, getting rid of some of the most abusive trial lawyer enrichment schemes where these trial lawyers walk away with hundreds of millions and billions of dollars while real victims with real needs don't get the money that they need to take care of themselves. That now is the major source of funding for the Democratic Party, more so even than organized labor.
So at the end of this 10 years or 20 years, whatever it turns out to be, 40 years if it goes along the lines of the Democrats, do you see a stronger, happier, more unified United States of America, Grover Norquist?
Absolutely. I think the country will be significantly stronger both economically, culturally, socially. Individuals who can stand up and say, I'm in charge of my own life, I can control my own family's future, I'm not buffeted by the government telling me what to do or any company telling me what to do because I can move around and take different opportunities. We'll have more independence for individuals and more opportunities. This is all about freedom and opportunity and self-control. It's not about wealth. You could decide to go be a priest and not have any money at all. The point is you should be free to do what you want to do.
Grover Norquist, we will be watching, but with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Hey, thank you.
Grover Norquist joined us from Washington. He is president of Americans for Tax Reform and making a lot of things happen in the Washington of George W. Bush. Jack Beatty, there's a vision of the nation.
Yes, and Grover says that the aim is to get a flat tax, to do away with progressive flat taxation, and that will be on the ballot in the 2004 election. Because if we get Mr. Bush for a second term, I'm almost positive we're going to get a flat tax.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, President Bush responds to questions about the faulty intelligence used in his State of the Union address. This is On Point. President Bush today brushed aside criticism that he used faulty intelligence to build the case against Iraq during the January State of the Union address. Speaking with reporters in Pretoria, South Africa, the president sidestepped a question about whether he regretted using the flawed intelligence. Bush's statements came 2 days after the White House acknowledged that its allegation that Iraq tried to acquire nuclear materials from Africa was false and should not have been included in the State of the Union speech. Here is the president responding to a reporter's questions earlier today.
Do you regret that your State of the Union accusation that Iraq was trying to buy nuclear materials in Africa is now fueling charges that you and Prime Minister Blair misled the, misled the public?
Look, there is no doubt in my mind that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the world peace. And there's no doubt in my mind the United States, along with allies and friends, did the right thing in removing him from power. And there's no doubt in my mind when it's all said and done, the facts will show the world the truth. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. There's going to be, you know, a lot of attempts to try to rewrite history, and you know I can understand that, but I'm absolutely confident in the decision I made. And
you still believe they're trying to buy nuclear materials in Africa
right now?
No, were they? I mean,
one thing is for certain, he's not trying to buy anything right now. If he's alive, he's on the run, and that's to the benefit of the Iraqi people. But Look, I'm confident that Saddam Hussein had a weapons of mass destruction program. In 1991, I will remind you, we underestimated how close he was to having a nuclear weapon. Imagine a world in which this tyrant had a nuclear weapon. In 1998, my predecessor raided Iraq based upon the very same intelligence. And in 2003, after the world had demanded he disarm, we decided to disarm him. And I'm convinced the world is a much more peaceful and secure place as a result of the actions.
President Bush speaking with reporters earlier today in Pretoria, South Africa. Jack Beatty, the White House says, yes, we had some flawed intelligence in the State of the Union speech. There was not this attempt to buy the yellow cake from Niger. President Bush is very clear today. There is no doubt in his mind that the threat was there and the threat needed to be addressed.
There's no doubt in his mind, but there are more and more doubts in the mind of senators and congressmen and people in the press, editorial boards. And there was no doubt in the mind of Joseph Wilson, the ambassador who was sent to Niger to look into this. In a op-ed piece in Sunday's Times, he spoke of the way they twisted intelligence and misrepresent and did not take cognizance of the report he gave them, which said that the Niger documents were fraudulent. And in an interview with the New Republic, he spoke of lies. Here he speaks of twisting the truth. But he ends, he says this, "The act of war is the last option of a democracy taken when there is a grave threat to our security. More than 200 American soldiers have lost their lives in Iraq already. We have a duty to ensure that their sacrifice came for the right reasons." And, of course, sacrifice of 7,000 Iraqis, the equivalent of 84,000 Americans, have died. Now, the statement that, you know, "I did not sleep with that woman, did not have sex with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky," was a lie. Now, Bush's statement in that, but it had no one died in Monica Gate. The statement that President Bush made in his State of the Union about the weapons, the effort to get nuclear material, was a misrepresentation. Or a lie, we don't really know which, who was fooling whom. But that had very grave consequences.
And there, I guess, the president would agree one way or another. In his view, it was necessary for world peace. We'll see if that's the final conclusion and view. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.